All right. Welcome back to the Rock and Roll Ghost podcast. This week we have Chicago chef John Mannion. He's the owner, operator, chef of Elche. Is it Steakhouse and Bar now?
Sure. Elche, Steakhouse and Bar, Elche, you know.
Yeah, I forgot because I know there was a name change. And then you've got, are you still associated with the place in Berwyn?
No. I just helped Will set up Baby Gold Barbecue. That was kind of a coming out of pandemic thing. So they're Steve Dominic's running that now. I think they're in good hands, but I didn't necessarily have the bandwidth to, we got it up and running, but that's not mine.
Gotcha. And then now just open is Bracero.
Bracero.
Which if you had a chance to visit La Serena Clandestina back in the day, I can't believe I'm saying back in the day for something that doesn't seem that far away, but I'm gathering Bracero has some elements that you would have found there.
Bracero definitely has some La Serena DNA for sure.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah. What was the motivation to get another restaurant up and running? I know there was talk a while back of you doing different things with different people and things kind of just changed. And actually, one of those things I interviewed you for an article for Eater that never materialized. It was back when Mark Steuer was with you at Elche, and then he ended up opening Funkin' House, and now you're in what was Funkin' House. You know, kind of, it's been a weird road, I guess, since the last time we've talked.
Well, I mean, it's just funny how things work out. You know, like I lived in this neighborhood for, I don't know, man, 25 years. And, you know, I moved to Berwyn 6 years ago or so. My wife and I decided to start to raise a family, and, I missed this neighborhood. And when the opportunity arose to, step into this space, it seemed like a natural fit. You know, Moss was a big part of my, I guess my origin story here in Wicker Park starting in 98. So, it just kind of felt like full circle coming back here.
Yeah. Yeah. What was the, what started the idea of Bracero? Was it something you were working on? Was it the space came up and you're like, I like the space, I like the neighborhood, let me figure out what to do here? What was the genesis?
Well, I mean, honestly, my partners at Che were partners at Bracero or at Funkin' House, and when that didn't quite pan out, they approached me first, and at first I was like, absolutely not. But you know, the idea of one coming back to this neighborhood was really appealing to me. I've always been big on Westtown, Ukrainian Village, and love the idea of coming back here. Two, you know, the older I get, the more wistfully I think I look back on like the Moss days, the late 90s. And I've taken this journey with the Live Fire Argentine food. But, you know, when I was a kid, I moved to Brazil when I was 8 years old. And those are really the memories that fueled this whole thing, my whole culinary career. When I moved to Chicago to try to become a chef, what I really wanted to do was explore those Brazilian flavors. And I did at Moss in the 90s, early 2000s. And during that time, I started to go to Argentina in earnest, and really fell in love with that method of cooking. But as you know, Brazil has its own kind of open fire charcoal cooking with churrasco. In any event, long way around the mulberry bush for your question. When this opportunity arose, the more I thought about it, the more I wanted to kind of explore the other side of the South American coin that really, really makes me tick.
Yeah. Yeah. I always forget, and forgive me for not knowing, but what, I mean, your family moved to Brazil for a while when you were young.
Yeah.
Were they, did they have ancestry there? Or
No. Both my parents are from Buffalo, New York. Good Irish kid from, and you know, I grew up in Detroit because my dad worked for the Ford Motor Company, which is what brought us down there.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, Uncle Henry, as we called him, brought us down to Brazil. They opened a plant in the late 70s outside of São Paulo. So there we were.
Yeah, and you were there for how long was it?
About 5 years.
That must have, I mean, it obviously made an impression.
Yeah, it was a super mind fuck, you know, especially at that age. I had the world was so much bigger back then, you know.
Yeah.
The idea of Brazil was just another world. Completely.
What was it? Yeah, sorry.
No worries.
Was it culture shock as a kid, you know, coming from America?
Absolutely. Like, I think that what kind of got me into food initially was, you know, when I was a kid, I was super picky.
Yeah.
All the things that gave me great comfort did not exist in São Paulo. So you found out pretty quickly that, you know, lobster is pretty good. And and spaghetti bolognese is pretty good.
Yeah.
And all kinds of things are pão de queijo and picanha and, you know, chorizos and all these things are pretty good.
Yeah.
So we had the opportunity to travel quite a bit too. And I don't know, as an expat, especially during that time, you know, there wasn't, it's hard to, I feel like an old guy saying this, but there wasn't much else going on. So our lives centered around, you know, being with other people and mostly sitting around tables and, you know, talking about food to the point where it became like, you know, at dinner we talked about lunch and at lunch we talked about dinner. And that was kind of it.
Yeah. Yeah. How old were you when you first tried wine?
Oh man. I, you know, my dad was in the Seventh Army in Germany. So beer was really my intro to that. I would imagine in high school.
Okay. I wasn't sure if maybe it was down there because maybe they have a little bit of a freer European sort of mindset about, you know, giving kids a sip.
I'm sure I had a sip of beer along the way, but it was never, you know, I think that in Brazil it was way more caipirinhas and beer.
Yeah.
That's what was happening.
Well, the reason why I asked about wine is because honestly, because of you or, you know, you and your people and your restaurants is not that I'm a connoisseur, but I've gone out of my way to search for South American wines. And, you know, I'm not much of a drinker, you know, I mean, I do like the occasional Italian and all that, but I found that the South American wines are, and maybe it's more of a modern age thing, but are quite extraordinary.
Juncture coming back from the pandemic, myself and working with our wine director, Alex Cooper, when we opened up Che, I always wanted to do an exclusively South American wine list, you know, and we were at Mas and La Serena. We definitely veered towards South American wines. Prior to opening Che, I was in Mendoza for the first time in probably, I don't know, 8 years. And both there in Buenos Aires, I got the sense that there was this real fucking revolution going on in South American winemaking that, like, not only had a lot of young people who had been overseas working in vineyards all over the world come to realize that they had something really special in South America, but a lot of the bigger houses were understanding that what they had have in the terroir, in the altitude and the sunlight, the amount of sunlight makes for extraordinary, extraordinary wines. So there's, you know, a revolution going on both there and in Argentina and Chile in terms of winemaking. So when we came back from the pandemic, we started tasting to rebuild the wine list and came to the conclusion pretty quickly, like we can do this. We can make this extraordinary wine list out of South American wines. And it's opened up all kinds of doors for us. It's been really amazing. You know, I kind of liken it to when I was a young cook here in Chicago, going to Spiaggia and looking at the wine list and being like, fuck, I don't know any of this. And having, and people, you know, because it was in Italy, there's more grapes and varietals and regions than anybody could ever possibly know.
Yeah.
But the staff there, the somms and the wait staff, they had the patience to explain, like, this is from volcanic soil. This is from here. This is from there. This is different. And, you know, we'll get you into something that's going to go with your meal. And I think that the same is true. I think that we're at the very tip of the spear in terms of understanding South American wine in the United States. I think that a lot of people in the U.S. have a less than enthusiastic view of South American wines, that they're cheap, and of low quality, but that's the furthest thing from the truth.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, maybe this will start that revolution, but I can attest to not being a major connoisseur again. And every bottle of South American wine I've tried has been phenomenal. So,
no,
and I don't know what, and I don't know what the hell I'm doing. So, so.
Well, you know, there is a school of thought that like, there are no experts, just people who have taste.
Yeah. I mean, that can be said for most things, I suppose. yeah, thinking back to your time when you were there as a kid, what was it what was it like for you to live there in terms of, I mean, what, as an American, what was the how did people look upon you? What was the political environment like at the time? Because obviously South America in general has gone, you know, is finally come out of a lot of, not that they don't still have trouble, but they came out of a lot bigger trouble.
Well, 78 was like, it was still a military dictatorship. It was the Cruzeiro at that point. So that was in literally the hyperinflation. Money would literally burn a hole in your pocket. So I think that most people in South America, in Brazil at that time, had a positive to indifferent view of North Americans.
Yeah.
You know, the thing about Brazil that's important that I don't think, because we don't do a lot of trade, you know, culturally, there's not a lot of back and forth between Brazil, at least this, you know, Brazil and the middle of the United States, maybe more so in Miami and New York and LA. But Brazil is a country that has its own shit going on. They like, to a great extent, I think that we have this idea that we're the center of the universe here, and that it couldn't be further from the truth in Brazil. They have their own musical identity. They have their own cultural identities. They have different regions, different cuisines within these regions, different, like, it's, you think this is a melting pot. It's even more so in Brazil. So I think that, you know, in terms of being viewed as American, it was with, it was positive or indifferent or curiosity, but there was no anti-American feeling at all.
Okay. Very good. Yeah, I'm sure around that time would be more Central America probably hitting us
for
more.
Sure. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I do remember, and this has got to be, I guess it's 1980, traveling from Brazil. You know, we had to come back to the United States every 6 months for visa purposes. Mm-hmm. And when we did that, we were allowed to kind of go anywhere we wanted to. So we went to visit the Panama Canal.
Yes, Noriega.
Yeah, well, the day that we arrived was the day that the Shah of Iran also arrived in Panama to start his exile. And the place was on fucking fire. There were just riots in the streets. So we mostly stayed in our hotel room in Panama, but like, you know, there was, yeah, certainly a lot of instability in Central America at that point in time.
Yeah. Well, it's not like it's doing great right now either.
You know,
it seems to be causing a lot of headlines around our country.
Yeah.
Well, you know, take me through, you've got the space, you know, you had the space, you had the impetus for looking outside what you do at El Che Bar. How do you start focusing on what you want to accomplish at Bracero?
I mean, okay, the creative process is different for everything. In terms of the vibe, you know, it was very important to me that the space be totally different. This was not a coat of paint situation. The vibe needed to be completely different than its predecessor. Mm-hmm. So we started working with Siren Betty to work on the interior design. And there, I think the jumping off point was, guys, it's imagine if you will, 1978 São Paulo, which means nothing to anybody but me, maybe. And even that's just kind of like, you know, whatever memory means. But so we worked with them pretty diligently over the course of several months to come up with the design in this place, which I couldn't be more thrilled with. I think it's fucking breathtaking. We started working with Hi-Fi Designs for the graphic. the graphic design, which is, you know, not something we've ever done before at the inception. But for me, having a whole cohesive thought is really important. You know, like I said, that the jumping off point was São Paulo 1978 and everything that entails. So getting that vibe right before, even before you start cooking, for me is important. I need it to be a holistic thought. I always have menus written in all over the place. I have a running, you know, Google Doc that's got lists of ideas and dishes. And then, you know, I start to kind of like divide that up into different sections and thinking about how a menu could work or how I want to compose it. So I, you know, wrote and rewrote a menu, started working with the core management team here. Four cooks, my CDC, Adam Meyer, Zach Ertz, and Melody Arnold, both the sous chefs here. We started cooking at Bracero probably about a month before we opened and worked through everything several times. So that was really a, you know, while the kind of wrote out all the ideas, super collaborative effort and the most fun I've had cooking in a long time. I haven't worked with such a talented crew, I don't know, ever. And they had a lot of influence on where the menu ended up. The baseline here, you know, I talked about Brazil a lot, but, you know, for me, the baseline of food was just delicious, and it doesn't necessarily have to fit into it needs to fit into the Bracero box, but not necessarily anything else. You know, and we can define what that is, as long as, you know, there is what I see as a through line or a narrative to what's on the plate. So nothing seems bizarre or all over the place or random.
Right.
And I think we achieved that.
Yeah. I mean, I the way you're describing that makes me think that we're kind of in an era where either you're trying to, we're going back to either trying to appeal to as many people as possible by kind of dumbing things down, or you're going to have to really zero in on specifically what you want and making that as perfect. And maybe, and I'm not saying anything that I'm not saying anything you've done is not creative, but I think we've kind of stepped out of an era where everyone was just pushing each other to just one up everybody else and try, you know, deconstruct this and deconstruct. There's still room for that, but I think there's more a need, especially in these uncertain times economically. It seems like getting your message clear and showing what you are and what you want to do, or you just need to go out and be a, you know, some kind of version of, I don't know, bubblegum shrimp or something.
I do think that there's, you know, I've always been, you know, I'm old enough to have cooked through a lot of eras of, you know, what's popular or what captures the imagination. You know, I think that when Michelin came to town, I don't know if it's the general public, but, you know, certainly the media, cultural elite started to consider, I don't know what I would consider more intellectual food as more valid.
Yeah.
So, you know, when you see, when you talk about, if you talk about Michelin stars and that sort of dining and that sort of experience, I've never really been that interested in it. You know, like when El Bulli was happening and, you know, leading up to, you know, I was very interested in when I was young and got to eat at Trotters, but when El Bulli was happening and the subsequent iterations of that, that still has, you know, still ripples through our dining scene, or the, you know, the vernacular of what we consider fine dining. I don't know, for me personally, I've always been well more interested in the visceral experience of dining than the intellectual.
Yeah.
So I've never dabbled.
I mean, there's certainly a place for it, but I think what everyone was chasing El Bulli, you know, back then. Mm-hmm. And you had everybody trying to be molecular chef.
I think to an extent, though, like, people still are.
Yeah.
Whether they know it or not.
Well, there is that. There has to. I mean, I don't think that goes away, but I think what's happened is that a lot of the casual to not, you know, to middling, have been cut out. And with any fad, I suppose that's what happens. You like, you know, and then somebody chases a new fad. But I'm not even sure what the hell a food fad would be nowadays.
I honestly think that we're living in an interesting time where, you know, coming out of the pandemic, there is, I think for a lot of the larger groups or larger restaurants, there is this need to provide comfort, to provide familiarity. That's why I think that we're seeing a lot of the same kinds of restaurants opening up, particularly in larger spaces, or we're starting to veer into a lot of larger spaces that are as much nightclubs as they are restaurants. And that's, you know, certainly like if you're interested in making money, that like that's a thing, and people seem to really like that. But I also feel as though there are a lot of mid-range smaller places that or independent restaurants that are kind of stretch their legs a little bit more. I look at like you know what Erling and Josh are doing down the street. You know, it's not a dissimilar restaurant to this, where it's just kind of like, okay, this is the food we like, this is the environment we like, this is what we're going to do. And I think that people are going to like it as well. Otherwise, I wouldn't be doing it. But I can't say that it's a, you know, it's a Kaya, or it's a Italian steakhouse, or like, I don't know, like it is influenced by my time in Brazil, but I'm not Brazilian, you know, like these are just memories. These are just like, this is just a jumping off point for how we're cooking here, you know?
So it's homage. It's a retrospective. It's, you know, it's basically, you know, trying to evoke, you know, an idea, a feeling, a thought, you know, and giving people something that, you know, to enjoy rather than, you know, sitting there playing around with, you know, ingredients and, you know, minimalist art, you know, plating and all that stuff, I guess.
Yeah, well, for sure. I mean, I don't know, like, but my plating tends to be pretty simple. And the baseline is just like, I think that the goal here is that it's fun. It evokes a feeling from the room to the service to the food. People find it comforting and maybe a little bit exciting. But like the base, like I said, the baseline is it's gotta be fucking delicious. You know, one of the things that I talked about with the cooks when we started this is, you know, and what I had hoped for is, you know how like, you ever been to Giant?
I have not. No.
Okay. Giant is like one of those restaurants where it's just like, it's a lot of pasta, right? But it's just kind of like, it's not Italian. And it's not all over the place. It's not scattershot. It's just like the through line there, the thread is it's fucking delicious. And it's like soul satisfying. And it's just like nourishing. And that's kind of what I wanted this to be. It's just the through line is, you know, I can see that there are definite influences and bigger flavors and bolder flavors and, you know, acidity and spice. But at the same time, it's just fucking good, you know?
You know, you've gotten, from what I've seen, two really good reviews so far. Number one, I think Michael Nagrant wrote about you guys, I believe, pretty quickly, which he doesn't normally do, he said.
No, really? Very quickly.
Yeah. And our mutual friend Tony Fitzpatrick raved about it when he went. So I'm not expecting anything less than fantastic when I eventually do go.
Well, you know, man, that's what we're shooting for. Fantastic. Tony's, you know, one of the reasons I'm happy to be back on Chicago Avenue is Tony is like I said, I spent years over here. He's a giant over here, literally and figuratively.
How are things going so far since you opened? It's only been a little over a month, correct?
It's like a day over a month. It was a month yesterday, I think. They're going great. I have no complaints.
Okay. Is there anything you're planning on doing that you have thoughts of that you'd like to try with the space, or with the menu, or with anything that you're toying with, but just want to get everything tuned in first before you start.
Well, I'll tell you what, we spent about a month tuning this up. So like what I'm super concentrated on right now is just executing every day. Mm-hmm. And fine tuning, and I think that the product we're putting on plate since day one is pretty terrific. But I am definitely in the stage of we're going to keep on walking before we run. Mm-hmm. I'm super proud of the staff here and the product we're putting out. But like, I don't have any ambitions outside of this. Like, what are we going to throw in a grill this summer? I don't know. It's not necessarily one day at a time, but it is. We're just going to focus on this right now.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Was it I haven't talked to chefs in a while, but has it gotten easier getting line cooks, or is that still a challenge?
You know, it's always a challenge to get it's always a challenge to get staff, but it always has been. But it's not, certainly not like it was coming out of the pandemic. And you know, I think that our culture is pretty good here, and that tends to attract good people.
That's good. That's good. Now, one question, and this goes back to something kind of Michael Magrin has been focusing on a lot lately is media and influencers and all that. What's your take on, it's still a very hyper, you know, food media, hyper Instagram influencer, what have you, era. Mm-hmm. That doesn't seem to have abated at all since I've left Eater. What do you make of this, and how do you feel about it? How do you approach it? You know, just anything around those subjects.
I mean, like, if nothing else, I'm a pragmatist. Like, I understand that. I think that if you don't, how do I put this? I bend like a reed in the wind. I don't know. Like, this is the world we live in, and I have been doing this a long time. I think that if you're not ahead of where we are, mm-hmm. you're in grave danger of being behind it. I think that, you know, the way that quote unquote influencers work now are very different than, say, pre-pandemic, whereas it used to be like some spoiled, rich, vapid person would try to, you know, get you to give them free shit in exchange for a whatever post. Mm-hmm. It's not, I find that a lot of the influencers that I know or I've worked with are pretty thoughtful about what they're doing. They can help you reach a demographic that perhaps you would not be capable of otherwise. You know, is it a form of advertising? Sure, I guess. I think that you can pretty much vet who you want to sort of quote unquote cover you.
Right.
I don't think that it's necessarily their fault that, you know, conventional print media is dying.
Yeah.
So I don't know that I have any really strong, you know, my grandfather's a newspaper man. I love the written word. Yeah. I love journalism. I love what Nagrin does. But I am not morally outraged by groups, people manipulating the system for their own gain. Like, it's always been kind of, you know, I admire his moral stance. I think that I wish that people would have the same standards. Mm-hmm. I think because he has such high standards, he's become a very important voice in, he fills a void. He's a great writer. And there's really not many other people legitimately reviewing restaurants.
Right.
I don't know.
Yeah, no, it's become a weird thing because, I mean, major publications, it's becoming obvious, are not filling their food writing staff with a budget to review like somebody like Phil Vitale did. I mean, you know, the man used to go to almost every iteration of Next when he was the dining critic, and there's no way the Tribune's going to do that, you know, similarly. For sure,
but
now.
But at the same time, like, people don't fucking read the newspaper anymore. So, right. Are you just shouting into the void? I mean, it's certainly, like, a review like Phil's, you know, getting a 3-star review back in the day would ensure butts and seats for a long time. It's not really the case anymore.
No.
You know, and in terms of, like, I mean, I don't know. It's not payola, but the thing that we do as restaurant owners, probably the best thing we do is employ people and give them a place to thrive and work. And really our biggest responsibility is to them. So putting butts in seats, I don't have like, I sleep pretty well at night. I don't spend a lot of time thinking about this, you yes. know, like
no, I guess
I need to feed my staff and I need to try to turn a profit in this business. So, you know,
it's obvious though, from what something you said, that you do vet people and you don't exactly take on all comers.
No, I mean, you know, the thing that people are going to like post whatever they post. It doesn't like whether it helps or hurts. It doesn't ever really hurt. I don't know. Yeah. I mean, I think that there's a lot bigger issues in our business right now that threaten our future than
such as.
I'm worried about how we're going to navigate the elimination of the tip credit.
Okay.
You know, I think that the long rollout does not help us at all. Because it's not, we don't have to make a decision to go from one thing to another as an industry. People are just going to try to navigate it alone as we always have. So I don't know. It's just like, and maybe there are, some people out there getting filthy rich from owning restaurants. I don't know many of them, but it gets, you know, it gets harder and harder in this city, in this state to run a viable business. You know, I don't worry about like, but I, you know, I eat out these, in terms of, just a moral stance, like these random 3.5, 5% charges added to checks that don't seem to actually go to the employees, but rather the bottom line. I think that's kind of a bigger story.
Right. That's definitely something that's post pandemic.
Yeah. And that's a thing, you know, that's like, ask people who work for these companies, it doesn't go in their pockets.
Right.
So I think that of like shady shit going on in our industry, like, some kid wants to get likes, doesn't bother me.
Yeah. No, I was just curious because, and you know, you keep hearing talk that the economy is getting better, but it seems like inflation truly hasn't, you know,
it's even much. It's evened out. It's not, it's not like it was a year ago. Yeah. I think that I am optimistic about the future. I don't want to think too far ahead, but like things seem to be going. I mean, for us, things are going very well.
Right now, are you paying less for product than you were a year ago?
No, we're paying about the same.
Okay.
But it hasn't continued to go up.
That's the good thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I think a lot of people are still thinking in this time that you still have places, companies that, you know, and maybe this is outside your purveyors because you work with a lot of local people. So it's understandable paying what they need because you know it's going to be quality, you know where it's going, you know where it's coming from, the whole bit. But a lot of companies, like the bigger companies that sell to restaurants, are still, you know, their prices are still exorbitant when they might actually be able to start bringing their prices down. They're just...
no one's going to bring their prices down.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. You do have leverage. You have power. You have like, it's not, no one has a monopoly.
Right.
You can go out and, you know, spend the time and make a spreadsheet and figure out who's buying what and change purveyors, you know, like fuck them.
Right. Yeah.
That's the way it goes. You know, if you're not compromising the integrity of what you're doing, but like, if you were talking about toilet paper and cleaning supplies and all the other shit we have to spend money on here.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Definitely.
Who are you using, for Bracero, purveyor wise or, you know, meat and et cetera?
Who do I use for?
Like purveyors, like you're for butcher, you know, for your meat, for your, you know, who are you work with? What farms?
I get some local meat from Vander Farms beef. You know, Che, that's what we do is beef. I use Creekstone almost exclusively for beef. And then meat, almost everything that we do goes through Winningham and Alsip.
Okay. Wow. Awesome. I grew up right next to there. That's why I'm okay. Just saying, wow.
Yeah, I've been there.
All right. There was something else I was going to ask you. Crap, if I can't forget what it was. Oh, shit. Why am I blanking out? I'll probably cut this out because I really am stuck.
No worries, man.
So you're not considering anything else at the moment near Bracero is where you're stopping for now, but do you envision 3 or 4 years from now? Do you see yourself getting a third?
I mean, yeah, there's all kinds of situations. You know, here's the thing, like opening the second has kind of there's a big jump from one to two, which I've done before, not necessarily well, where you need to create an infrastructure that can support both and hopefully scale. So it would be easier to add a third concept or business to this model than it was to go from one to two. So I don't really have anything. Well, you know, I've always got ideas, but right. I don't have anything necessarily that I'm working on right now.
Gotcha.
You know, what I can worry about is like what's right in front of me right now.
Gotcha. What sort of places have you been to in the last year that are hopefully still open that you've been particularly amazed by in Chicago?
You know, I'm always gonna like, you know, that it's no secret that Bouchon is like my happy place in Chicago. So I've been there a few times. I think that Obelix, I had dinner there on Sunday, fucking delicious. One of the best meals I've had in a long time, and I've had this meal before, but like Haisu ate there recently.
Okay.
God damn, man. Like, if you like that, we serve a whole fish at Bracero and we serve one in Che as well. I love, like, eating a whole fish is my idea of a good time. Yeah. And their whole fluke is like, is one of the best dishes that I've ever had. It's fucking phenomenal.
Yeah.
I had, you know, speaking of fine dining, I had a great meal at Kisama not so long ago.
Okay.
Those guys are just like ridiculous.
That's become an insanely hot spot.
Oh, for sure. I mean, it's not far from me. There's lines on the block every day for their breakfast.
Yeah. Have you been to Warlord?
Never been. No, I haven't been.
Yeah. I've heard good things, but I just after hot dogs, I've stopped waiting in lines for food.
No, me too. I'm super interested in what they're doing, but like I got two little kids, man. I don't like. I'm not eating at 1 o'clock in the morning. Where else? I went to Maxwell Trading. I thought that was like, I love what those guys are doing there.
Yeah. Obviously. Yeah. 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 I'm glad to see Erling, back behind, the
woo. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. There, you know, it feels like I've just, you know, ever since I stopped writing for Eater, I just kind of stopped trying to hit every new spot, and it, you know, it makes me sad when I miss a place, and especially during a pandemic when they close, it's like, oh, I should have gotten there. And, you know, it's like, but I'm not in the city anymore. And, you know, I'm not writing about this like I was. So I don't have the ability to keep going out all the time.
No, I understand, you know?
Yeah. Probably the last thing I got to ask you is, have you ever been approached to do any TV cooking competitions, anything like that?
Yeah, no. I mean, yes, I have, but no, I'd rather not.
And any particular reason why not?
You know, I talked to the magical elves. I talked to Top Chef years and years ago, and this is during the Moss days, and that was early on. And I was kind of like, "Why the fuck would I want to do that? It seems awful."
Understandable.
What could possibly come of that? And that was the season. And you know, I'm not saying that I would have been on the show at all, but that was the season that Steph won. And it was like, oh, I can see what can come of that. But, you know, now I just don't, I don't, it's never been, I'm not like, it's not why I do this. I mean, of course, there's things that, of course, I will do a lot to put the restaurant in front of as many people as possible. The restaurant's the business that we do. It's, for a lot of reasons, it doesn't appeal to me. I don't want to be recognized. I don't want to be famous. I don't want, like, I don't, that doesn't, that didn't fill my bucket. That doesn't nourish my soul at all.
Well, I'm guessing you're not exactly a big fan of competing in terms of cooking. It feels.
No, I'm not at all. Not a fan at all.
Yeah. Or have you ever been a competitive type person in sports or in general?
You know, I think that I'm not competitive, but I am in fact super competitive. All I want to do is win. So yes, but I think that, you know, for me, there's certain things that you do for yourself and there's certain things you do for other people.
Right.
For me, this is all about nourishing people and making other people happy. So I don't like that competitive, making that into some sort of competition doesn't make any sense to me at all.
Right.
I don't know. It doesn't. Watching a cooking competition show on television, and certainly I've done it, but like, you can't fucking taste this. You can't smell it. Like, how the fuck, how do I know? You know, like, you're just, it's just entertainment. It seems like, you know, if you're going to watch a football game, you can see who wins at the end. Right. Like, just like judges saying shit smelled, tasted, looked good. fuck is that?
I get that. I can definitely understand that. Okay. One more, you know, you are married, father, two children.
Mm-hmm.
You own two restaurants, so I'm guessing there's not much room for much else. But when you do have time for yourself, what do you typically like to do?
Oh, shit. Well, I haven't had a whole lot of time at all in the last 6 years. So I would, you know, I remember liking to travel. It's funny, this, you know, after opening a restaurant for two, traveling, I remember being fun. I remember going out and seeing a lot of live music. That's not something that happens to me anymore.
Yeah.
I used to see like every fucking movie that came out, and it's funny. I was just talking to a friend of mine, and he was saying, "Oh man, I just saw Dune 2," and I'm like, "Well, I went on Monday and saw it." He's like, "How the fuck did you do that?" And I was like, "I took the day off. Like, I had to actually." I told my wife, "Like, this is what I'm doing."
Yeah,
I'm going to the movie theater. I'm going to sit in the dark for 3 hours and no one can fuck with me. No one can bother me. It was a little slice of heaven. So, normal guy stuff, I guess.
Okay.
All right. But, you know, now it's like, it's a lot of kid stuff.
Yeah.
Which I also enjoy.
Yeah. No, kid, well, stuff. Sure. You wouldn't have had them if you weren't going to enjoy it.
Oh, you might be surprised.
I raised one, trust me, I really enjoy it. Yes, I know. What did you think of the movie?
Oh, that was fantastic.
Yeah.
What I thought about that movie is like, how come why can't other people, like, there's so much fucking bullshit out there. Like, this is everybody really operating, and I mean, of course there's holes and whatever, but there's also like sandworms and spaceships, so I'm willing to suspend a lot of belief,
right?
But yeah, it's beautiful. It's well acted, well directed, all the crafts amazing. I think as an old guy and a fan of cinema, it's fun to see Denis Villeneuve just kind of like go off on all these influences, you know, like David Lean, Star Wars, Apocalypse Now, all these things that like he obviously loved, and it was fucking, as a film nerd, it was cool to see that all to come together.
Yeah.
No, and also some shit you've never seen before.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
like it was really, I would, there's very few, I honestly, not since The Empire Strikes Back, have I like wanted to sit in a movie theater and watch it just over again. Right. I just want to, like, I'll watch that right now. Another 3 hours. Fuck it. I'm in.
So I thought it was good. Yeah, I'm eager to go see it one more time myself before it leaves theaters, because, you know, the first one and this one are just such incredible experiences on the large screen. It's hard, even with all of modern, today's modern technologies, it's not easy to replicate at home.
Yeah, no, I saw it in like a Dolby theater.
Oh, me too.
And I will tell you, there were some like sounds that actually startled me.
Yeah,
which was fucking cool, you know?
Yeah. No, I love the Dolby theaters. They're the best. If you're going to see a big movie, you know, like that, you got to see it in a Dolby theater.
Yeah, you know what? I went to go see it in IMAX, and the guy was like, dude, you should actually see it in Dolby. I think it's better.
Yeah. And then, I mean, but if you could see it in 70 millimeter IMAX, which I don't think anybody here has it, like Music no, Box has it like in 70 millimeter. There's IMAX, but there's not both.
No, one of my sous chefs went and saw Oppenheimer, like Indianapolis, to see it in 70 millimeter IMAX.
Right.
Like, dude,
right. It didn't even play here in that format. Uh-huh. It played in 70 millimeter film here, which I got to see, which was cool. But nowhere near here. Yeah, it was kind of a bummer. I would have liked to have seen that.
Although somebody told me Dune is showing 70 millimeter film at the Music Box. Is that?
I had just said that. Yeah. I don't know if somebody else told you, but yeah, they're showing it there.
That would be cool.
Yeah. All right, man. Well, I'm glad everything's going well for you. It's good to catch up. It's been a while.
Yeah, man. Thanks for taking the time.
No. Thank you. I'm trying to get back into talking to some chefs because I know you guys need, you know, every bit of help that you can get. And if I can help in any way, that's fantastic. Yeah. And I'm looking forward to coming in at some point too, because I love your food. I mean, I still think about the La Serena pork Milanese that I had with an egg. And I'm like Guy Fieri in the fact that I am not a fan of eggs.
Yeah, that
I liked your egg.
that's something we might do again someday. Not here, but who knows?
Yeah.
Who knows?
All right, John. Bracero is now open. Go check it out. Elche is still open. Go check that out. Thank you very much for taking the time.
Thanks, Brett.
Best of luck to you, and hope to see you soon.
Appreciate it, man.
All right. Talk to you later.
All right. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye.